This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. HBR's Kuʻuwehi Hiraishi joins us this morning to talk about the promise of a plan on the Valley Isle, where a bitter fight over water has long been brewing. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So the end to a nearly 16 years contested case hearing for Nawaiʻeha, so the four great waters of Wailuku, has come to an end. And in the eve, I believe, of the closing arguments or the day of the closing arguments, Mahipono, the ag venture over on Maui, had gone ahead and announced that they've come to an agreement with the Hui o Nawaiʻeha, which is a longtime group of community stewards of the water of Nawaiʻeha, taro farmers, also Kuleana land owners, and OHA, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. And this agreement basically lays out this sort of roadmap on that's really going to, I think, from what people are saying, change the direction of how we treat water here in Hawaii's public trust. So some of the things in this agreement was to, one, I guess the amount of water that Mahipono had agreed to divert from the streams was less than it had originally. Its predecessor, HCNS Sugar Company, had requested from the Commission on Water Resource Management. They've also committed to irrigation efficiency, which is something that I know a lot of the farmers who use the water in stream have been fighting for a really long time. So sort of figuring out where the system is losing water or leaking, or figuring out how to patch that up so that the water does flow from Mauka to Makai, from the mountains to the sea. And they've also agreed to have this allocation be non-transferable, meaning this can only be used for Mahipono's crops. I think there was a lot of sort of rumors flying around about Mahipono later using this water for development in some way, right?
That's always been the fear, yes.
Exactly, but that's been put to rest with this, with the agreement. So we should say that the agreement is just the beginning of things. There is still a little hesitancy or a little doubt on how it's going to play out. But folks are, I'd say, cautiously optimistic.
And we should probably point out, because maybe folks aren't familiar with Mahipono.
Yes. So Mahipono, they've got about 41,000 acres they bought. It's a joint venture. I mean, we talked about this earlier, between a Canadian pension investment group and also a California agricultural company. And the goal is, and the mission is, to produce a fresh local food over in central Maui on land that was acquired from the former now defunct plantation. And so part of what will make their crops grow is this water. So they have requested water both from Nawaiʻeha, so from the Wailuku side of Maui, but also from East Maui irrigation coming off of Haleakala. And they are trying to be a bit more efficient with how they, phase in development or phase in these crops. So they've started with potatoes so far. They've got, you know, they're going to kind of phase that in. But as they go, they need to secure these sort of water rights. And so part of this contested case hearing with folks on Maui, and at least in Nawaiʻeha, was to figure out, for the Commission on Water Resource Management, to figure out how much water they're going to allow to stay in stream for things like the marine life in the stream, but also for folks who have sort of public trust use rights to it. So Kuleana land owners, taro farmers, and then how much can be diverted for things like Mahipono, but also other private users, including, the county takes water off of this. So still a public cause, but not a public trust use necessarily. Anyway, so speaking to Isaac Moriwake, he's an earth justice attorney who's worked on the Nawaiʻeha case for more than 20 years, nearly 20 years. And, you know, this agreement, this idea that you can come to an agreement before going to the Water Commission, right? So this is handled outside of that, not having to sue and go through court, a long-time lawsuit. This was a turning point, he says. Here's Moriwake.
So they're going to be the biggest end user of all that stream water on both sides, but definitely in Nawaiʻeha going forward. And so this opportunity to come to an agreement with them as the biggest end user, the biggest agricultural user, was really important to set the tone going forward that we're moving from the old plantation system of taking all the water mm-hmm. and never mind everybody else, and more sort of balance and efficiency and respecting, you know, the resource as the public trust.
Right. So these four streams or rivers, Waihe'e, Waiehu, Iao, and Waikapu, were once sort of this entire area was some of the largest taro producing areas back in early Hawaii. And when the plantations came in, it was one of the first areas on the island to be diverted in large amounts, all this water. So returning that will sort of spark something that kalo farmer Hokua Pellegrino is really looking forward to, but the restoration of traditional agricultural systems in the area could be something that could help Hawaii, at least in his view. He's the president of Hui Ona Waiea, which was the group that came to this agreement with Mahi Pono. And he says, you know, it's hopeful, but we're not going to, you know, write this off just yet. We're not going to let them go. We're going to keep an eye on what Mahi Pono does. Here's Pellegrino.
You know, the proof is in the pudding, right? I mean, these guys, you know, this is a big corporation, you know, similar like their predecessors in terms of having, you know, that, you know, financial backing and, you know, large landowner. And it's really the burdens falling upon them to really execute on these actions that they've committed to. And I don't think anybody should feel any differently at this exact moment. You know, it really... We, you know, for the Hui part, we want to see that this is going to come to, you know, the commitment's going to come to fruition, and that they're going to stay true to what they said they're going to do.
That's right. And we did reach out to Mahi Pono, who had pretty much said they don't want to celebrate just yet. They don't want to go up and make do the media rounds because it's important for them to sort of stand on their actions. And they know the history of this area and the history of the relationship or the distrust between the community and the former plantation and former landowner. And so they want to make sure that they get some action. You know, they make good on some of these commitments before they start parading around.
And you reached out to Shan Tsutsui, the former
right.
lieutenant governor.
Exactly, who's a vice president of operations and who was at the commission, the final closing arguments for the Commission on Water Resource Management. And he did sort of talk about how they want to be better stewards. And hopefully this stipulation agreement is a step in that direction. And getting back to sort of how long this process has been, got to talk to Moriwake again, the attorney, about what this means moving forward.
It took a long time and a lot of hard work by the community on the ground, and of course the legal process to enforce the law. But now you see today, all four of the Navajo rivers and streams are flowing from Mauka to Makai. There's no question that streams have to flow, and that people have the right to flowing streams to support all the uses, not only the ecosystem from Mauka to Makai, but also to support community farming like taro growing, and there's no turning back.
Right, so the commission expected to make a decision in the next several months.
Okay, and we'll have to see if they give the nod, but thanks
exactly.
so much.
All right, mahalo.
That was Kuvehi Hiraishi talking about a deal struck over water between Mahi Pono and those who have long battled the sugar industry. To read her stories, go to hawaiipublicradio.org.
Thank you.
Have you had to call the handy van lately? Well, Honolulu Civil Beat gives us our reality check with the growing wait times. Reporter Marcel Henri joins us this morning. Hi.
Hey, Catherine. Happy Monday after Thanksgiving.
Yes. And you know, this story is one of those boomerang stories. I mean, how many times have we done this, right? Wait times in the handy van. I thought Mike Formby dealt with this already.
Yeah, it just seems to be a continuous problem. Just there's a multitude of issues with the handy van. And, you know, one of the problems is, I mean, you could look at it as a blessing as a curse or a curse, but it's one of the heaviest in demand per capita paratransit services in the nation, if not the busiest per capita. So with that comes a whole lot of headaches and, you know, both city and Oahu Transit Services, which runs Handyvan for the city, they're constantly trying to keep up with this demand. You know, and it's $2 a fare, and they point to that makes it a very lucrative system to use that hasn't been updated and that fare hasn't been updated in about 20 years. So this story I wrote today really focuses in on the wait times just to book a ride, just on the reservation phone line.
Yeah, somebody in our office tried to book something recently, and they were on terminal hold. It was crazy.
Yeah, so Charlotte Townsend, who is the vice president at OTS, who helps oversee Handyvan, you know, she was talking about this at length at a recent public meeting, and she put the average wait time where users are sitting on hold, you know, looking to book their rides, at 20 to 45 minutes. On top of that, the system itself sees frequent crashes, sometimes some major, you know, day-long crashes, which, as you can imagine, has very large implications for these users. These are, you know, ADA-qualified disabled users who rely on the handy van to get around. And a lot of times that is for, you know, very important appointments. So it does have large implications.
Yes, because many appointments are made for medical reasons.
Right. You know, you'll hear a lot for, you know, dialysis and things like that, things you can't miss.
Now, your story points out that somebody has actually filed a civil rights complaint.
Yeah, this is Donald Sakamoto. He is the president of Citizens for a Fair ADA Ride, short, that's known as CFODR. And it's a local advocacy group for paratransit riders. He filed this earlier this year after a couple of major crashes in the phone line, saying not only is it, you know, very unacceptable and inconvenient, but it also violates, you know, the FTA regulations, federal regulations for a system that relies largely on you know, federal funding. So he has filed something with the FTA's Office of Civil Rights, and my understanding is that the city and the FTA have been talking about this recently, and he, you know, everybody's hoping that we can resolve this and make this a better service.
And I'm sure that Townsend is just beside herself, because she was a longtime user, and there are just great hopes for, you know, putting someone in there that knows what it's like to be on the other end.
She is, and despite all the problems that Handyvan continues to face, you know, I've noticed just particularly in these public meetings that Townsend is very popular with at least with the you know, riders that show up and testify at these public meetings. They don't really hold it against her. Meanwhile, she is saying that she and her staff are just as frustrated as they are with a lot of the software. Not just the city's system, which OTS operates its reservation line through, but also their dispatch software, which is run by a company called Trapeze, and that those two things combined, she says, just cause them all sorts of headaches. And you know, there are other options out there that could make this a lot more user friendly.
Right. So you've got a number of issues. You've got the reservation line issues, right, the software, and then you've got an aging fleet, I guess, which breaks down, which doesn't help.
Right. You've got all sorts of, you've got the aging fleet. You don't have enough space for the growing fleet, and they're still trying to make, you know, on time rides. You know, forget the reservations themselves, even, you know, waiting for your ride, and on time is considered either 10 minutes ahead of time or 30 minutes after your scheduled pickup time. So you could have a van arrive 29 minutes after your scheduled pickup, and it's still considered on time. And, you know, even with those parameters, that pretty flexible window, Handy Van still has issues with its on-time performance.
Okay, so we're negotiating with a new vendor, and hopefully that'll work, huh?
Yeah, they're looking at a couple of solutions. You know, maybe allow riders to book online, give them that option, and also maybe a callback system like you'll see on some of these customer service lines.
Okay, I guess, but we've got to keep our fingers crossed that that things hold together until we get something new in place.
As always.
Thanks so much, Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's reality check. Go to civilbeat.org to read that story and more.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, celebrating the holidays with A Very Merry Holiday Pops at the Hawaii Theater, 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, December 10th. Tickets at hawaiisymphonyorchestra.org.
It's the end of the year, and you're probably reflecting on the months past and the things that mattered most. December is the biggest month of the year for charitable giving. Like many causes you care about, HPR is a nonprofit organization, and our end of year fund drive starts on December 10th. I'm Courtney Thomas from HPR's membership team. Help spread the holiday cheer and support HPR this December. Give today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Haleakala Waldorf School, and Honolulu Waldorf School.
We were fortunate to have had the chance to sit down with the Bay Area father and son last week to talk about a project they worked on together. Chinatown Rising is the name of a documentary that's playing this weekend at the Doris Duke Theater at the Honolulu Museum of Art.
Rarely do the Chinese in San Francisco organize themselves to express an opinion on public issues. But that has changed.
I knew Chinatown was different, but I don't know if anyone else really understood.
Chinatown at that time did not think they have a problem. So I was the one saying, no, we have a problem.
We must bring self-determination to our own community.
America is all about fighting the system when it's not right.
People move!
My gut says, you just can't do this. This is not right.
I don't think really that anybody give a damn. That is the real issue.
I didn't think that my films had any lasting consequence that would not change anybody's life.
That was a trailer from the documentary Chinatown Rising. Filmmakers Harry and Josh Chuck sat down with us in our studios. Harry starts off talking about how a childhood fascination with his box, Pin Camera, turned into documenting the start of the civil rights movement in an immigrant community faced with a housing crisis.
All this sort of came to a head when I discovered movies. And I used to borrow people's 50-foot films of Joe Louis boxing and very famous personalities and historical events. And those sort of, you know, was part of the fascination that I had. I suppose that it was all about history, and I had that, you know, growing interest in history.
And you were watching then all this tension in Chinatown, and you just whipped out that camera and just started shooting.
That's true. That's true. And the reason why I was able to do that was because of my involvement as a student at San Francisco State University. And I was working on a program in film arts. And this was to be my final film. And if I could produce this film before graduation, I would get my diploma. As it was, I became so involved with the civil rights movement that had touched down on Chinatown that I just kept shooting. And I really couldn't keep up with the editing. So I just kept shooting. Whenever I heard some commotion outside, gunshots, you know, people shouting, chanting, marching, I would just run out into the street with the camera. Before I knew it, I had accumulated quite a bit of footage.
And then you kind of forgot about it in the basement, huh?
Well, yeah, I started raising a family. I had a full-time job. And so a lot of this film footage just got put away.
And so fast forward, Josh, a time came, I guess, to clean the garage, and you folks came across all this wonderful film footage.
Since I was involved in film work a little bit, he asked me what he should do with these boxes of old films he had. And he actually mentioned, you know, should I donate them or should I throw them away? And I told him, just wait right there. You know, don't do anything. I'm going to come over and we're going to figure out what's on these film reels. And I was able to convince him to digitize the film footage, which is very, very expensive. But he was willing to do that. And when I first saw the footage, I thought it was really interesting. It was clean. It was well shot. But I wasn't sure what it was about. And so it wasn't until we started interviewing contemporaries of my dad and who were activists at the time. And that's when I found out how significant the footage really was.
So what was it like then to see your Chinatown through your dad's eye?
It was really incredible. I was born in the late 70s. And so a lot of the events that are captured in the film are not long before I was born. You know, 15 years, 10 years, 5 years before. Yet the world that I see on the screen there is completely different than what I grew up with. I grew up feeling very American and feeling like I had all the opportunities in the world, that it was just up to me and how hard I was willing to work. And when I heard the stories of how life was for Chinese just 20 years before I was born, it really amazes me that there were so many challenges and that we had so many heroes who were willing to fight to make life better for our community and just to provide opportunities, the ones that I enjoy.
So you folks had to then hunt down some of the people in the film. So your dad's friends, I guess, right? Was it hard convincing them to kind of update, you know, the situation in Chinatown?
Yeah, there were 4 decades between the time these events took place and the beginning of this film. And I thought initially that it would be difficult to convince people to cooperate in this venture. But I was surprised. They were actually quite interested, although many of them claimed to have, you know, forgotten some of the events.
Probably did.
And they probably did, yes. And I think that as they started talking, you know, we had to coax them sometimes to talk. And Josh was very good at this because he was really interested in understanding what had happened. As people began to look at the footage, they kept saying almost, you know, as a chorus, they said, well, I wish my kids, you know, could see this. Our kids, then they would say, our kids really need to see this. Because our generation had come through a period when, you know, we were just happy to have any opportunities for education and for jobs. And our parents didn't have any of that. You know, my folks didn't get beyond the sixth grade, and my dad had some issues with immigration, so we never spoke about those things. And now it seemed like we were liberated. We could talk. We could express ourselves. And the people that we interviewed, they truly felt energized by by this opportunity to talk about the past.
And then, Josh, mm-hmm. talk about, I guess, maybe what you found to be the most moving thing in this whole process, from start to finish.
I think my answer is kind of personal. Throughout the film, we use my dad as a thread because he was present at a lot of the events that occurred in that were pivotal for the movement. And he wasn't only present, but he was involved. And for me, it struck me that I didn't know most of these things about my dad. And I think to think that without doing this project, maybe I never would know about the many things that my dad did and the things he achieved. I feel very grateful that we did the project and that I was able to learn about my family history.
And do you have other siblings?
I do. I have an older brother and older sister.
So you're able to kind of share this other side of dad.
For sure. For sure. I think family stories are so important. And it's been inspiring that audience members have come to me later after watching the film and said, I decided to interview my family because I saw your film. And I think these personal stories are, whether they're exciting or seem really interesting or not, they're so important.
Yeah, the film itself, or the pieces of film themselves, have a story of their own. And we were quite lucky in that we did not sustain any damage to the film stock. And I also, in reflecting, looking back after having finished this film, had I finished the film then, I probably would have lost a great deal of footage, because in those days, you cut and paste and cement it. And what you didn't use ended up on the cutting room floor. With digitizing, you never lost anything. You could keep going back and reworking it. And this was a blessing. And of course, I didn't know how to do all that stuff. I saw myself turning these rewinds and looking at the different frames. But when the younger guys, like Josh and his friends, began to help with the editing, they just went flying by, And so without them, we would not have accomplished completion of this film.
And talk about what this means to you personally, knowing that your son has kind of picked up the torch and completed this, and you've completed it with him. I think that's probably the most amazing thing, amazing part of the story, is that the two of you completed this project.
Yeah, I have many friends who are quite jealous, actually, because Josh wasn't born until I was 44 years of age. And we completed this film. I just turned 84. So we did this father and son thing, but it wasn't only about the film, but it was about coming to know each other and to respect each other as adults. And I don't think, this happens too often. So I was extremely grateful for that. And I think both of us, whenever we have a chance and we begin to reflect and talk about these things, realize that, this was a gift.
And to think that you really did have to put it away, and put the project on pause, but having resurrected it, you've got maybe a much richer product at the end of the day, because you're bridging the generations, and then you can tell the story, I guess, with fresh eyes and then juxtapose against what's happening, I guess, in the city today?
I really do think this is a story of American history. The story of America is immigrant communities coming here and figuring out who they are and what their place is in our society. And that's how we made the film. We wanted this film to be about our community. And it's made by our community. I think that's so important, because a lot of times others will come into a community and find something fascinating or interesting.
Right, but this was by and about.
By and about us. And throughout the editing process, we really try to focus on that. Like, what are the stories that the history books, if they had our story in there, can't tell? And that turned out to be the personal stories of the people who were there. And so we really focused on that as opposed to something you could find on Wikipedia or something like that. And so this is really a unique story that's so important because as I learned the stories, I realized how similar they are to stories today. Maybe not in the San Francisco Chinatown community, but in other communities. And it's really important to see that history does repeat itself and that, you know, we have a role in figuring out how to make a just society. This whole effort has been pretty grassroots from the beginning, and the screenings that we've had have been grassroots efforts. A lot of times just our core team putting these on. And the audiences have been really enthusiastic. I mean, pretty surprisingly to me, they have just been gung-ho about how can we help get this out there. This story needs to be told. It needs to be seen by as many people as possible. When we mention some of our longer-term goals of getting it possibly on public television, and then getting it into classrooms, that's when people really get excited. And we're excited too. We're ready to take this to the next level. And, you know, especially we get excited about young people watching our film. We can't wait to see who comes out because, you know, audiences, when they watch the film, there's a lot of things that make this film meaningful for them. And we're just excited to share.
And then anything else just about, you know, the whole issue of housing in San Francisco?
It's all about housing. I mean, it was around housing that people gathered to protest the unfair practices of landlords, the encroachment of big business, and the and a sudden awareness of students that they could make a difference. But then the miracle behind the story is that they couldn't do it without the help of the seniors. And it was the seniors who sort of came out of hiding and became a part of this cross-generational experience. And when you watch the film, I think it's difficult for people to imagine how this could happen. But you know, as we worked on this film, I began to recall what had happened during that period. And actually, I became so involved that eventually I served on a number of city commissions on affordable housing and on homelessness. And I spent 12 years on the San Francisco Public Housing Authority. And I had a chance not only to witness what was happening in Chinatown, but throughout the city and the reforms that really needed to take place. So when it came right down to it, it was up to the communities to organize themselves. And much of that energy came from the campuses around the Bay Area. And the students, very often, they would forsake their classes to show up at a public hearing. And then we knew that they were really serious.
Any other takeaway for you?
Now that I'm at an age to have witnessed what's happened in San Francisco so far, and the prices have been of housing they're astronomical, and the challenges that brings. Nothing hits home as much as having a place to live. When you don't have that, everything else seems just so challenging. You can clearly see the forces at work in San Francisco right now, and I think in a lot of places.
Well, I think listeners out there have a number of reasons why they should go see this film. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Harry and Josh Chuck talking about their documentary film that will be screened in Hawaii for the first time at the Honolulu Museum of Art this coming Sunday afternoon. To find out more, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation supporting the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting In the House, Recent Acquisitions, Newly Obtained Contemporary Works at Spalding House through December 15th. HonoluluMuseum.org.
This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer. They talk two significant anniversaries with our robotics explorers on Mars.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet. Also, things we can look for in our dark skies. As usual, we're lucky we've got the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips to tap into, and he's waiting for us right now on the line. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be back. So this week, Stargazers, it's your opportunity to catch the planets of Jupiter and Saturn before they slip below the horizon for winter. Both planets can be seen in the west after sunset. The moon this week will appear as a waxing crescent and provide the perfect accompaniment to our dark, star-filled skies.
Now, we've got a couple of robotic anniversaries we're celebrating on Stargazer.
Yeah, well, they're more like Marsiversaries. The first is for NASA's InSight lander, which touched down on Mars 1 year ago and has been listening diligently to the internal goings-on of the red planet. The second Marsiversary is for the rover Curiosity, which has been roaming the surface of Mars for an astonishing 8 years. Both of these intrepid robotic explorers may have different jobs, but they share the main goal of helping us understand the red planet by exploring its geology, chemistry, and weather.
And explain to folks the difference, because InSight is a lander and not a rover, so differentiate its capabilities.
Well, InSight has a very particular mission. Basically, it's to sit in one spot and monitor Martian earthquakes, or Marsquakes as we call them, and to gain any clues as to whether Mars is still geologically active. For this type of mission, sitting in one spot is more beneficial than roaming the surface.
Wow, you just raised an interesting thing. So they're not earthquakes anywhere else. They're something quakes.
Yeah, it depends on where you are.
Right, I like that. And then thinking about Curiosity, it's been examining rocks. Now, there's a whole lot of information that can come from taking a close look at some geology like that, right?
Absolutely. Rocks may seem boring by the exciting standards of space exploration, but they can tell us an amazing amount of information about a place. Rocks are like books, storing all sorts of information about a planet, including how they formed and how they have changed over time. By studying rocks, Curiosity has revealed that Mars was almost certainly awash with liquid water at some point in the past.
And the rocks would probably be worth a whole bunch of money, though, too, if you could bring them back, right? Be like, rock from Mars. Put that on eBay. That's got to get a little bit of dough.
Almost priceless.
And finally, are there going to be more Marsiversaries you've got planned for a future episode?
Indeed. In fact, InSight is set to continue its mission for at least 2 more years, and Curiosity will keep going so long as its wheels will let it. So here's to celebrating many more years of Martian exploration.
It's Christopher Phillips, and another update on the Red Planet and some anniversaries of our robotic explorers up there. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for another Stargazer, and we keep them at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Genki balls are part of Hawaii's green future. Creators of the little balls of soil and mud packed with microorganisms believe it's the answer to water pollution, and they are taking aim at Honolulu's Alawai Canal. We first told you about this idea back in spring as part of Earth Day. Well, the 7-year cleanup project formally kicked off last week. Our producer, Harrison Patino, went along with students from a nearby school.
Ready? Okay, guys, ready? 1, 2, 3,
stop! That's the sound of 3rd and 5th grade students from Jefferson Elementary tossing their own homemade Genki balls into the water as part of the Genki Alawai project. Organizers hope that the sludge-eating microorganisms found in the balls will help clean up the polluted waterway. The goal is to restore the canal to the point where people can fish and even swim there, all within the target time of 7 years. Marianne Kobayashi is a retired school teacher and the school coordinator for the project. She says helping clean up the canal is a real-life lesson for her students, one outside of the classroom.
We spent time, we sifted the soil, and then, you know, we actually had them form the balls. And they saw the microorganism grow out of the balls, that white fuzzy things. And then, you know, and now it's ready. The microorganisms are now active. And so when you put it into the alawai, they will work on the sludge right away. So they've been learning about the alawai, the problems of the alawai, and about how microorganism can help the environment, and so they're really into it. We should start very early, kindergarten or earlier, just looking at their own environment and be problem solvers. You know, this is a hands-on approach, and it's pulling all of the different curriculum together, English, social studies, you know, because they study about issues. They learn Hawaiiana, they learn values, Hawaiian values. Not only, you know, science, not only water quality or, you know, and it's mathematics when they work with the launchers.
Those launchers are the students' preferred delivery systems for the Genki balls. Think makeshift slingshots, lacrosse sticks, and catapults. Anything to fling the packed brown balls into the canal to make the experience that much more hands-on. Paul Arenaga is the outreach and project manager for the Genki Alawai project. He says it's important that kids are taking part in the cleanup process at such an early age.
It's really great because it's actually integrated into their STEM curriculum. And the Department of Education is implementing this new standard or set of standards called the, New Generation Science Standards, which are very kind of hands-on oriented and teach critical thinking. I think that the younger generations are already, particularly when it comes to environmental issues, because they are going to directly affect them more than they affect us even. I think that the younger generation is much more aware, more motivated. My own adult children are constantly chiding me, kind of assigning blame. Thanks a lot, baby boom, Generation X, for messing up our world. So, and rightly so, actually. So I think that this kind of activity, aside from, you know, like the hard knowledge learning aspect, it's the whole soft side, which is just they're raising awareness. And you know, it's also sort of a kinesthetic thing because they're throwing the Genki balls in. It's an experience. It's not just book learning. I think they'll really, really remember this experience.
Arenaga compares the experience to throwing out the first pitch at a baseball game. While this style of application is new, the science and technology behind the Genki balls themselves is more than 35 years old. First developed by Professor Taro Higa of the University of the Ryukyus in Okinawa, Genki balls have previously been used to treat ponds at Hualalai Resort in Kona to treat detritus, a common cause for algae bloom. The balls themselves are inexpensive and simple to make, with each ball adding up to little more than 20 cents apiece. Hiromichi Nago is the president of EM Hawaii. The EM stands for Effective Microorganisms, the bacteria-eating component of Genki balls. He describes what they're made of and how they work.
It's clay soil, EM, effective microorganism, some rice bran, and molasses. So EM is a mixed culture of lactic acid bacteria, which is used to make yogurt, cheese, yeast, used to make beer, wine, and then phototropic bacteria, a very special one, that feeds off on our detritus, hydrogen sulfide ammonia, that's their food, and what they produce is a lot of enzymes and antioxidants.
Nago says that the day is significant because it marks the beginning of a healing process for one of the most polluted waterways in the country.
Today is celebration of starting day to heal the Alawai Canal, especially with the students as part of their STEM, their science, technology, engineering, math project. They did a lot of research on the Alawite Canal, on the microbes, you know, just so relevant. It's their backyard. A lot of issues with the Alawite Canal, pollution, dredging. We're talking about flood mitigation. It's all part of their students' education.
Researchers behind the project estimate that with Genki balls, the Alawite could be returned to that swimmable, fishable state within 7 years. After seeing a couple hundred children enthusiastically fling microorganism-packed mud balls into the Alawite, however, Nago figures the job might be done in five.
That was the conversation's Harrison Patino, who recently attended the inaugural ceremony kickoff of the Genki Alawite Cleanup Project. We have run out of time, but up tomorrow, we talk smarter energy use, how to better control residential water heaters. We would like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation, Hawaii Talks.